You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. This is Sound Poetry, Radio Tacoma, 101.9 FM. I'm your host, David Gilmore, and today I'm welcoming Michael Schmelzer, a poet of renown in the Northwest from some prizes he has won, a book finalist called Blood Song of fairly recent vintage by the Two Silvias Press, and a previous chapbook, Elegy Elk River, that we won't hear from today, but some from Blood Song. He has poems of the sanguine and the sanguinary, and he says that he can actually tilt rose-colored and ridiculous. And I think that probably sums up some of the poetry, the verses that you'll read. But many that you'll read will find harsh, maybe hard and stark. But there is also a very, I would call, terrible fragility at work that balances out the harshness. And so welcome, Michael, to Sound Poetry.
Thank you so much for having me. I know this is a long time coming. I think you contacted me over a year ago, so I'm very excited to be here, and I'm very thankful for your patience as I navigated everything.
Glad you could make it. And it's probably the case with many poets we've connected. They want to speak in person, as you and I are, rather than doing it through the zingy Zoom technology, which doesn't always sound as true to the voice. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Michael is going to read just a couple of poems from Blood Song. And since there are those two, he might read those together as a brace of poems, and we can go from there. Okay. So, Michael, start us out with your the verse of the Some Nights the Stars They Sour.
Okay. Some nights the stars they sour. One hears a strand of hair singed by flame. This too a song that reminds us how swiftly music turns to stench. I spent weeks tuning the smell. It was as useless as my mother after her mother died. Years pass and still, so heartbroken, she plucks and burns every gray curl she finds, moving only to empty the ashtray. Some nights the stars they sour air with light. We battle silence with a bottle of wine, drink enough to find darkness profound. I tell you this because it explains why sunrise stalls on the horizon like a car built before our birth. Although we don't recognize the make, we recognize the smoke from the tailpipe as something breaking down. Call me a thief when I lift my sick daughter from the bed without the sheets noticing. What time is it? None of us are dead yet, so I believe it's still early, and chirping nourishes the morning. Little bird, little god of flight, land on the branches of my splintered fingers. Do you remember our inheritance, our names? I whisper them as a reminder, here and now, slit your feathered throat so you pronounce us properly. And then this next piece, I always have to thank a friend of mine who gave me a writing exercise. He gave me the title, and I was to go from there. And so the one thing I should mention is that I thought was interesting, Isaac Newton's father was also named Isaac Newton, and he had passed away before the scientist was born, or basically a little after he was born, I believe. Isaac Newton's teeth. When I was young, I flicked my father's flimsy earlobes as if they were fat little bells, and I was happy. Then one day I stopped. or he left. I don't know enough about the order of things to say which came first. The smallest force creates a chain of events we shackle to the ankle of our futures. You've heard this too. The monarch's wings, delicate to the point of non-existence, breath by breath causes a microburst across the world. How much worse the damage then, caused by the whip tip of a finger stinging and stinging a father. Our ignorance often accelerates us. So much of what we know of motion, propelled by what we don't know about impact. Newton was born 3 months after his father died. Everything the scientist learns amounts to a speck of black pepper reacting against his father's teeth. Those small canvases of absence.
Thank you. Two poems from Vlad Song. There is a great deal more of the, I think, corporeal in many of the poems in Vlad Song. It's definitely devoted to the life that is in the body, of the body, and that spills out of the body, mm-hmm. which it is the life when the blood spills out, rather than necessarily dying. This one here, you have some interesting imagery about sunrises. Now, you were born in Yokosuka.
Yeah, Yokosuka, right? Japan, a Navy base in Japan.
In that peninsula there, not too far from Tokyo, or it's a suburb of Tokyo, mm-hmm. is it?
Yeah.
How long were you there?
So I was there until I was about 9 years old. So, and then we moved to Elk River, Minnesota.
But your mom was Japanese?
Yeah, she's from Okinawa.
Okay. So when you use the images of mother throughout your poetry, are you playing the part of a pretender, or is this drawn sometimes from your real life?
I think many times, especially in the first full-length Blood Song, is mm-hmm. very much autobiographical in some ways. I have kind of a fairy tale lens a lot of times, I would say,
yes.
But it is all very much steeped in things that have actually occurred. Mm-hmm. And for instance, my mother, when her mother did pass away, I mean, she was just obviously sad and depressed and alone. And that is an image I carry with me and remember. And looking back, I wish I would have had the skills to approach her and try to talk about it or comfort her. But being a teenager, you just don't have that capability. At least I didn't. I wasn't the type of teenager that could do that. So it's one of my regrets, is that I couldn't be better back then. And I guess that's a lot of what I think about, is not just regret, but how to grow from that regret.
Yeah. And so this, a lot of your life, did you tilt rose-colored before you became a poet?
I think I did. I think I've always been just a little bit, I don't want to say off, but I mean, I've always had that sense of whimsy, I think, in the little core of joy. And despite the more elegiac tone of my work, I am constantly laughing, constantly just goofing off. I'm probably considered pretty immature by people that know me, but hopefully in a good way. So I just think there are so many wonderful things to see and do and experience. And no matter how hard and tough and depressing life can be, I always try to remember that other side of it, that there is sweetness to the sour.
The ridiculous.
Yes.
Is a big part of your nature. Yeah, and you also have the word absurdity in one of the titles and within the poem. So I find that there is much in poetry that is so strange, mm-hmm. In the way that the stranger in Camus was strange. How do we come to grips with this person? It doesn't seem to be connected. Mm-hmm. Your absurdity comes really from, ordinary life, perhaps, that we are living. absurd existences. Yeah. And we've had a year or so of that.
Mm-hmm.
Did you write then some of these in recent months or the last year?
Most the two poems that I'll probably be reading from an untitled manuscript I have were newer poems. And I think I had this grand idea that Blood Song would be kind of a life. My next manuscript would be more concerned with afterlife. And then the third poem would be a kind of a joyful manuscript, a resurrection of sorts. So I had this very big, ambitious idea of a trilogy in a sense. So this poems where I'm thinking about joy and absurdity and that kind of ridiculous observations are very much from what I hope will be a third manuscript at some point, and is just more accurate to how I perceive the world, I would say, in a lot of ways. I see mm-hmm. the darkness and I see the harshness, but even through the worst of it, there's always something that I find very, very joyful and happy. Like even just little details and little observations about the world, there's always something that just really gets me. Yes. So I'm hoping to be able to hold on to that for as long as possible.
Well, let's go to the serving of absurdity in the next one. That is the next one, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay.
Through the exhaustion, I serve absurdity. Humans are, at their best, a mess. Like the palette at the end of a child's arm, when that child forgets the canvas itself and swirls on the thin slab instead. I think I fall in love at least a dozen times a day with a pigment, and hardly ever with an effort. To know me is to hear, "Look at the proportions on that cloud," or perhaps, "Oh, the mountaintop today," at least once in our friendship. It is a kind of enthusiasm that serves absurdity. I have found a compromise of wildflowers trespassing on the lawn, and every blossom snuck on tiptoes so as not to be noticed. Yet they wore the most brightly colored hats. I notice these things. I drive my aging mother a little crazy with the way I tilt rose-colored and ridiculous into the world. I drive my wheezing mother from hospital to home, home to store and store and store. What about this? There is still sweetness. I lift a lemon pound cake, a pumpkin pie, trays of chocolate chip cookies lined up like commuters on a bus. "Where are they going?" I ask. And my mother scowls, and I see the glint of off-white from her fake teeth and think, there, yes, oh, that color, that exact color. Yes.
That one, I think, shows your fairy tale, a little of your fairy tale world. But in the absurdity of life, do you take the way that we have such opulence in the aisles of grocery stores as sort of an absurdity?
I do. I mean, it's funny. I help my parents shop. I visit them weekly and help them. My father had a stroke back in 2018. So ever since then, I've been helping kind of take care of my parents. So I'm very much concerned about my aging parents and that kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, they go through these like, we don't know what to get. There's too many options. And it's true. There is just a ridiculous amount of things. And I hope, I hope I don't become that someday. I don't want to be stalled by choice, but it's already happening. So I guess there is that sense of, well, I will slowly become just overwhelmed by the world at times. And I'm hoping to keep the sense of joy even in that.
Yeah. Your mother seems to scowl, as you say here, because of your nonsense, perhaps.
Maybe yeah.
The things that you say don't always ring with parents who aren't attuned to the strange imaginings of a poetic mind, right?
Yeah, so I am very much... my parents were always very supportive and very loving, but they were... And including my brother, too. I have one older brother. All three of them are very different from me as far as I just seem to be the more quote-unquote sensitive artist type, and they... very much don't seem to be. So I don't think they knew quite what to do with me growing up, but it was a supportive environment. Okay. So.
When a person reads a poem, you can't stop the reader from thinking this or that. Mm-hmm. I read a good bit of Rettke when I was younger. Mm-hmm. Not that I'm a romantic poet, but I did enjoy his unusual metaphors and such. And the one that you have about the blossoms sneaking on tiptoes, so it's not to be noticed. Well, I remember a line of Rettke's where he says, "Isn't it amazing how the stones dance to the surface?" And I have noticed that since I was a gardener, you know, after I read that poem, mm-hmm. gardening every year in one of these plots, I realized, my God, they weren't here last year. They have actually come to the surface. Of course, it's the topsoil rolling off and things like that. But it's very interesting how nature has its own life. Mm-hmm. Do you think poets try to wrestle the life out of nature, or do you think poets are constantly supplying nature with unthought life, with things that are not often said?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure. I know my relationship with nature has changed as I've gotten older. I always thought of myself as kind of a city person, and especially during this pandemic, I've realized like the kind of the constant noise has been, despite the fact that things are supposedly have quieted down and people are more at home, but there's still that sense of just noise and visual pollution, I guess it would be. And I think there is something about nature that is important, not just for poets, but just humans in general need that space, that solitude, that quiet, where they can get a sort of cleanse. Yeah. And I think there is very much a life and spirit to nature that I don't know if I'm necessarily like placing that onto nature, but I do feel like there is something deeper than us that we can find in nature that I'm hoping to tap into. And I think sometimes it is just silly little things. I love little bugs, and I love knowing weird facts about bugs and how they move. And I think there's just so much fascinating, wonderful things within plant life. And I wish I knew more about the names of actual trees and flowers. Yes. I would love to be able to look at something and name it by its proper name. So I think there's magic in that.
You are a dreamer at some point, I'm sure, not only to come awake to images that that you find new and surprising in yourself. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the proportions on that cloud, there's nothing to be said to that. You're just saying, look, don't tell me anything about it, but just look. Yeah. And then, the mountaintop today, mm-hmm. geophysical perhaps in nature, but something that speaks for itself. Mm-hmm. And there the reader has to do the work of imagining and remember perhaps that effect. And it's not so ridiculous or absurd. Yeah.
I remember one time, and I think especially with the mountain, every time we're driving, we tell the kids, like, look at Rainier today. And my wife and I moved from Minnesota back in, I think, 2003. And my mother-in-law had spent time in the Pacific Northwest. She was like, have you seen Rainier yet? We're like, I don't know if we can see it from where we are. We were in Federal Way. We're like, I don't know. It's just cloudy. It's one of those. We're not quite sure. And she was like, yeah, okay. No, you can see it. Trust me. And there was one day where we were driving and we just saw it. Like everything cleared up and we saw it. We're like, oh my gosh, there it is. Like, of course we can see it. It is like, and it was just one of those moments that we don't forget. And it was really like a revelation to us that there's just this beautiful mountain right in front of us, and we didn't see it one day and the next we did, and we love it here and we love that view. So I just think nature is such a revelation.
First there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is. Remember that?
Oh,
that
vaguely,
verse?
Vaguely.
The appearance of Rhaenyra will be calling it Dahomey, I suppose, before long when it catches on, mm-hmm. which is probably good, because then we'll be saying, look at Dahomey today, yeah. and say, well, what are you talking about?
See, that's the proper naming of things. I think that's important, too.
Yes, it is. An antidote. Yes, an antidote or echo.
Yeah. So this was actually from a comment from my former MFA director, Stan Rubin, who is a brilliant poet in his own right. Mm-hmm. But he is the one with the quote that I have in here about poetry must be an antidote or it's merely an echo. So he is the okay. dear man that I speak of in here. An antidote or echo. A wise man once said nothing, and the fool agreed, but for the wrong reasons. I'm wise enough to know I'm a fool for electric words, a surge in the wiring of my brain. Here I am seduced by the way the right word in the wrong order can compose a cacophony I still call symphonic. A man dear to me said poetry must be an antidote, or it's merely an echo. The empty place where I hold the weightless things I cherish most. Your snore, for instance, when you predictably fall asleep before me, repeats antidote, antidote. I have found a way to agree and disagree simultaneously, and hence I'm a failure at debate. Isn't it a failure of imagination? We haven't created immunities that pass on like pathogens, something we give to another like a blessing after a sneeze, just by embracing. Open your arms. Who is the first person you would enrapture with cure? Everyone I love has placed their head against my chest and heard the emptiness echo inside me. Everyone I love knows what is wrong with me.
Well, I don't know you very well because I can't say too much that's wrong with you right now. So I won't be bothered to interpret too much into that. But I do, what I like a great deal about this one is that you're, in several of your lines, you confess yourself. For example, you're wise enough to know something, that you're a fool for electric words. Why not? Poet says the...
Oh, yeah.
Purveyors of electric words and a surge in the wiring of your brain. We have that frequency always,
yeah.
a buzz
yes,
in
we do.
Our brains. Yeah. So you're seduced by... This seems to be a very, very short explanation of poetry coming to be. It's mm-hmm. like you're explaining, I'm seduced by the way the right word... You're actually
yeah.
in a process.
Yeah.
In that one. Yeah. Did you find that the person that taught you some of the wisdom of poetry as antidote, did he read this and comment on some of the expressions?
And you know, no. I haven't even shared this with really anybody. I think this is maybe the this is definitely the first time I've read it out loud to anybody,
yeah.
but and I'm not as good at submitting my work as I used to be, so I don't even think I've submitted it much. So it's really new, and Stan himself hasn't read it yet. I will share it with him at some point.
Okay.
But he is just such an amazing writer, amazing editor, and just amazing mentor and teacher. And
well, we do... find a lot of great wishes too in your poetry, that the failure of our imagination, that we haven't created immunities mm-hmm. that pass on. Pathogens, we seem to discover them and spread them about, but mm-hmm. on the other side of things, on the antidotal
yeah.
side, very, very interesting twist there. We give another like a blessing after a sneeze, and then you say, open your arms, who's the first person that you would enrapture with cure? That again, we need to be antidotes ourselves. Mm-hmm. Yeah, to so much that's painful or frightening.
Yeah,
and yeah, this is has got some very lovely thoughts. To read it again, I'm sure that readers will understand how you have changed that into a wonderful metaphor. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kindness, here's another one. Kindness as a kind of weapon, we get, again, a sort of tender thought, too.
Yeah, and a lot of this has to do with some of the time I spent online. I've tried to steer away as much as possible lately from social media. I think it is a very disruptive and flattening mode of communication. I think it's awful in a lot of ways, especially for younger people. And so what I witnessed on that has been really kind of terrifying in so many ways. And I have been hounded online for various reasons. And one of the things someone had said about me was that I had weaponized kindness. And so I thought that was extremely fascinating. So strangely enough, I owe a lot of my forthcoming manuscript, this Empire of Surrender, that will be coming out. A lot of it was due to the fact that I saw so much cruelty online and was able to tie these private, cruel, personal moments that were directed towards me into a larger, more global narrative in some ways. So
that adds something to this poem already, as I think of it. Yes. So,
kindness as a kind of weapon. So often my name has played on the lips of those who hate me. I must be their magnum opus, a musical made by those who confuse the barrel of a rifle with the body of a flute. What music they create echoes in the emptiest halls, and yet they bow as if vitriol needed a soundtrack. And if such animosity can be a kind of music, then I have crafted kindness into a kind of weapon you can swing with one hand like a foam sword from a state fair. Here, snatch it from my hand. Beat me again and again until you're satisfied.
Yes. Kind, very kind sadism at the end. Foam sword. Yeah, there's one of the words that I was wondering about. Bow. The bow, I thought, are they violinists, viola players, bowing, cellists? Mm-hmm. and so I thought, which way does that go? So I was waiting for you to read that, and yet they bow as if vitriol needed a soundtrack. So you never know how far to take a line. I hope it didn't disturb you with that kind of thing.
Not at all, no.
Okay. And fragility. That's how we survive.
Yeah. And that's another thing, too. I've been kind of obsessing over the ideas of kindness and fragility and how do you make that into something that is more than just performative words, but how you live your life and how that actually can create revolutionary change. And so it's just more of what I've been thinking about is how to respond to hate and cruelty in the real world and what does that look like. Fragility is how we survive. Like a dandelion clock, for instance, blown apart by a fox's breath. That is how I've floated this far. Not by anything other than gentleness do I owe allegiance. It worries me how many follow the flight of an arrow rather than the path of the Pappus. When the world confuses worship and worship, all we can do is sink. Even sailors are more eggshell than coconut, but most nations remain machete-minded. I am as dangerous as an elegant spoon. I carry inside me the same golden thing even the most vile soldiers do. Strike me down if you don't believe. I break myself too often to prove so much less.
Yeah. Sailors are like eggshells, Humpty Dumpties. They're also much, much softer than coconuts.
Yes.
Yeah, so very, very interesting description there of the sailors. It took me aback to read that line. I thought, oh, okay. And now machete-minded, so you go from things that have a smoothness or a roundness to them to something then that is flat and sharp. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm not exhausted myself, but I am quite overjoyed that you came all the way from Seattle. Was it Seattle?
Yeah.
To join us and... This has been a real pleasure, Michael. Thanks for coming.
Thank you so much for having me.
This has been Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore, Radio Tacoma, KTAH 101.9 FM.